which is item number 5, our much heralded final report on monitored natural attenuation.
Wow, that was fast.
3 minutes, all right.
Okay.
That was so fast, I don't even have your item ready yet. So hold on. Alright. And here's this. And
okay, and where's the...
So just press on that. No, that's the pointer. So this is going to be... This arrow is forward, and that arrow is backwards. And the window one is your laser.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair and Board members. I'm Linda Stone, an engineering geologist for our Victorville office, and I work primarily on Department of Defense cleanups. The primary purpose of this presentation is to summarize the revisions to the draft report on monitored natural attenuation, evaluation and implementation in the Lahontan region. So just a quick review here. Monitored natural attenuation, which I will be referring to by its acronym, MNA, for the rest of the presentation. Monitored natural attenuation is a remedial option that relies on naturally occurring processes to achieve cleanup goals or objectives in a reasonable time frame. MNA is relevant to the Lahontan Water Board's cleanups efforts because MNA is currently being used at groundwater sites in our region, and we expect to see it proposed at more sites in the future. At Department of Defense facilities, we anticipate that it will be proposed at about half of the upcoming decision documents. In some cases, we're seeing MNA proposed as a sole remedy, and in some cases, the cleanup timeframes are extremely long. Because staff was seeing more M&A proposals, the board conducted a workshop on M&A at the September 2014 board meeting. At this meeting, the board directed staff to prepare a report on M&A that summarized the regulatory requirements, the USEPA guidance documents, and the board input regarding site-specific concerns and considerations on the use of M&A in our region. Based on this direction, staff presented the draft M&A report at the November 2015 board meeting. The draft report was also provided to the state and regional boards, DTSC, the EPA. There was also a 30-day public comment period. No comments were received from the agencies or from the public. At the November meeting, the board provided additional input on the draft report, and staff has incorporated this input into the final report that is before you today for your consideration. To incorporate the board input from the 2015 meeting, the draft report was revised to include more robust discussions of the following topics: assimilative capacity, institutional controls, financial assurance, and changes in land or water use. I'll discuss each of these topics in a little more detail on the following slides. The first revised topic I'll discuss is that of assimilative capacity. Assimilative capacity is the ability of an aquifer to accept a constituent while still maintaining the beneficial uses of that aquifer. The concept of assimilative capacity applies to all cleanup sites, but it is especially relevant to M&A because of their generally longer cleanup time frames, since the assimilative capacity for the constituents of concern will be impacted for the duration of the cleanup time period. The existing and future need for the impacted assimilative capacity should be considered when evaluating the cleanup time frame and also in establishing cleanup goals. For example, if the cleanup goal is set at the maximum contaminant level, that means there will be no assimilative capacity for permitted discharges containing that constituent, and that assimilative capacity will be lost and not restored when the cleanup is over, because they will stop cleanup at the MCL, when they reach the MCL. Therefore, we think that cleanup levels for constituents from unpermitted discharges should be set as low as possible. A discussion of assimilative capacity was added on Bates page 515. Existing and anticipated needs for the assimilative capacity is included as a consideration in the evaluation of M&A on pages 518, 521, and 522. The second topic that was revised is that of institutional controls, also referred to sometimes as ICs. U.S. EPA defines institutional controls as administrative or legal controls that help to minimize the potential exposure to contamination or to protect the remedy itself. The final M&A report was revised to emphasize the importance of establishing effective and reliable institutional controls and to include general considerations for the selection, implementation, maintenance, and enforcement of institutional controls. A discussion of institutional controls was added on Bates page 518. Institutional controls are included as a consideration in the selection of M&A on page 521 and is discussed as a component of the decision document on page 522. Additional resources on institutional controls were also included in the reference section of the report. The third topic that was revised was that of financial assurances. Financial assurances are used to ensure that the responsible parties bear the financial burden of implementing all remedy components, including long-term monitoring and reporting and implementation of contingency measures. These remedy components must be maintained until cleanup goals are achieved. Again, because of the generally longer cleanup time frame for M&A, the importance of appropriate financial assurances are necessary and especially critical. Financial assurances should be developed according to CERCLA requirements and EPA guidance, or if the site is being regulated under Title 27 of California Code of Regulations, such as landfill sites, then Title 27 specific regulations regarding financial assurances apply, and the responsible party must comply with those. The final report was revised to contain a discussion of financial assurance on page 519. Financial assurance is also included as a consideration when determining a reasonable cleanup time frame, which is on page 521, and as a component of the decision document on page 522. We also added a list of resources and links on financial assurances to the reference section of the report. And the last topic that was revised in the final M&A report is the discussion of changes in land or water uses that can affect the protectiveness or effectiveness of the remedy. We expanded the report's discussion of contingencies on Bates page 518 to contain specific examples of changes in land or water use that should trigger a reevaluation of M&A. These examples include increased need for the water resource or increased need for the assimilative capacity, and also changes in factors that could affect the behavior of the plume. So staff recommends that the board concur with the acceptance of the final M&A report so that the report can be used by staff and dischargers to guide the evaluation and implementation of monitored natural attenuation in the Lahontan region.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you have any questions or comments?
Board members, you have any thoughts?
How will this policy be used? Does this mean that remediation where you're going to apply M&A, they won't come to the board once we approve this? Or what's the mechanism in utilizing this moving forward?
I don't see it as supplanting the board's approval. The board will still need to be involved in the decisions as will Patty. I envision it as a guidance to help staff and the dischargers go through the process of evaluating M&A so that we're pretty confident of the regulatory and technical validity of the remedy before we bring it to the board.
Okay. That's very helpful. I just want to add, so what it would look like if there was a permit before you were, that was a consideration. You see a section described in there for cleaning. So it wouldn't change what comes to the board. You just now see a section of it where you, that would be the description.
I was really pleased with the policy. A couple of things I'd like to point out on Bates page 513. The sentence states the U.S. EPA M&A directive states that it expects that the use of M&A as the only remedial method would be appropriate in relatively few sites. So I really like the limited and judicious application of this policy. And then in Bates page 521, another sentence that jumped out at me. Ideally, M&A is used following active remediation as a polishing step and not the remediation in entirety. And then the last thought is on Bates page 535. And it's relevant to the third bullet point about the drinking water and groundwater supplies. Just thinking, this is applied mainly to military bases, thinking about Edwards Air Force Base in the middle of the Mojave and the former George Air Force Base right on the edge of the Mojave River. I would like maybe more restrictive consideration in places like George where it could feed directly into a waters of the U.S., whereas in Edwards, there's really no bodies of water out in that area that I'm aware of. So what are your thoughts about, using this policy as it relates to those types of situations?
Well, what we included, we heard board concerns in both the workshop and in the November 2015 board meeting. And what we tried to build in here was the site-specific considerations. And so we included, I think it's on, let's see, on Bates page 522, we have site conditions requiring additional evaluation. And a plume proximal to a population center. A plume impacts the sustainability of a groundwater basin. We didn't put anything directly about discharge to surface water, but that would be viewed as a receptor and would be evaluated in the process.
Well, I'm thinking maybe not so much the discharge, but the connectivity. I mean, mm-hmm. The groundwater under George Air Force Base at some point has relative connection to the river aquifer in that area. So I'm just kind of thinking of it in.
Yeah, it does. One of the plumes, it does at least one of the plumes poses a threat to the Mojave River. It does. So there is, that is, we consider that, but it's not specific to M&A. It's more of a receptor evaluation.
And then just a question maybe for Patty for my edification. Do we have a numerical limit for nitrates in the basin plan? Because I'm thinking as we're applying this policy as it may relate to nitrates, I would hate to see a dairy take up all the assimilative capacity for nitrates if a wastewater plant, which serves thousands of people, may need to use some of that assimilative capacity. Can you help me understand how that dynamic works?
Yeah, we do have basin plan limitations, and I think it's by basin.
I could maybe just because Mojave maybe is a little more complicated.
Yeah,
for the record,
My name is Lori Kemper. I'm the Assistant Executive Officer. So for all the groundwaters in our region, all of them, the drinking water standard is the nitrate limit. So it's 10 milligrams per liter. That has essentially been set as a narrative objective for all the groundwater basins in our region, unless the groundwater has been de-designated. So for those limited areas like we did at China Lake, where we said it's not a source of drinking water, then that standard would not apply in those limited instances. But in terms of nitrogen and surface water, they all are specific numeric objectives for our major surface water. So the Mojave has nitrogen limits for the river, which gets complicated because, as you know, the river only has a surface expression part of the time. But I think the way the basin plan is written, it kind of implies that, at least along the floodplain aquifer and that shallow groundwater, that we expect the nitrogen to be the same as when it's flowing on the surface. And those numbers usually are set as total nitrogen numbers, not necessarily nitrate. And that's more related to protecting aquatic life and preventing excessive algae growth in a river system. And then we also have specific numbers for lakes that are different too. So those numbers were set more on historical context of what the water quality was in the past. That's how those numbers were set in our region. So they weren't set at the level that protects beneficial use. It was set more like what was the high quality water at the time. So hopefully that helps you. So then in terms of, so for right now, our dairies and our wastewater treatment plants, we make sure that they don't go beyond 10, but that's where the more recent permits the board's been asked, we basically have discretion to set an effluent limit lower than 10 to try to preserve some of the assimilative capacity, and we can also set specific receiving water limits in the permit. But generally speaking, we've allowed the basin plan standard to remain as the receiving water limit, the 10, but then if we can get more nitrogen control, we've set the effluent limits below 10, you know, like a 8 or 9.
And I would just add too, just in terms of how it will be used, it's not a regulation. It's not going through the Office of Administrative Law, so it really is just guidance, and it pulls together, you know, great information from the different sources. So it helps staff to use that criteria to make those calls, but it's not like our basin plan objectives or, you know, those strict requirements.
It provides good clarity and transparency both to our staff and dischargers of what some of our expectations think they should think about when they put together their ideas of how they want to structure M&A. So it's just a clearer way of communicating to people, and we'll have some consistency in our region looking at this. So it's from other regional boards and the state board, this has been a very well received report, and other regional boards would like to have this from the board adopts because they would like to use it as use in their regions. It was a great bit of work.
No, thank you.
Other board member questions? Mr. Bias.
Linda, even though the board may accept this report as final, I would imagine that as we use it as guidance to implement specific M&A projects, we will learn possible improvements or modifications. Are there provisions for updating the guidance periodically?
We haven't discussed that, but I've certainly thought of it, and for that reason, and also because the resources are going to change, and I would like to keep it as a living document. And we've discussed putting it on our website, and I can discuss mechanisms to ensure that it stays current and relevant.
Thank you. It was a good report and a good presentation.
Thank you.
Other board member questions?
Just a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
I know on the Carson River, we have the Alpine Federal Court decree, and I would imagine in other watersheds you have similar things. And this regulates how riparian water rights, water storage, consumptive, hydro, cow fish and wildlife, as we talk about changes in ownership. Have you taken a good hard look at that, or in other watersheds?
In connection with M&A?
Yeah.
Well, we haven't. We don't have any cleanup sites So we're kind of doing it on a case-by-case basis. Okay. As a proposal for M&A comes in, then we start evaluating the receptors and the assimilative capacity, but we're not doing it as a kind of a planning approach.
I just wanted to...
Yeah, I'm not aware of any cleanups in that drainage basin.
I know there's an agreement in the Lake Tahoe Basin called the operating agreement. Mm-hmm. That you're far more familiar than I.
Yeah.
Thank you.
for my edification, I apologize. I didn't have a chance to read your wonderful report. So I was wondering, could you kind of walk through an example of how the institutional controls will work? So how does Lahontan get institutional controls into, say, a local land use plan or a...
A local land use
plan? Well, I guess a good example of how that would work is if we were going to accept M&A on as part of a cleanup. There would be a time period where that groundwater would not be able to be used. And so we would ask, as part of acceptance of the M&A remedy, for a deed restriction on the use of groundwater during that time period. So that would be an example of an institutional control.
At the county government level.
Right, so the individual landowner would agree to have their deed at the county.
Right.
It would be recorded, and it would restrict groundwater use.
Okay.
Now, how that applies then on the ground sometimes can be a challenge because it is there, though, to be enforced. And so that's one of the things to look at when we're assessing, are the institutional controls sufficient to protect the public? And enforceability is another one of those issues. So how does the county plug into those restrictions when they're giving well permits? And those are the kind of things that we have to assess when we're looking at M&A.
Okay.
And when I was going over the institutional control topic, EPA has a lot of good guidance documents. And they had one guidance document that was specific for developing work plans. So it's clearly laid out who's responsible for what and who's responsible for enforcing. And it seems like that is... A critical component to getting effective and reliable ICs, and something that we should consider. So I've included that reference in the report.
And do you see the new policy of there in California of there being a human right to drinking water affecting the M&A policy?
We included that as a kind of a regulatory framework, and so it's hard to see kind of specifically right now, but I think in the future it could shape how we go forward with that. So we did include a reference to that. Patty, did you?
Yeah, add on to that. Dee Diadamo, or a state board member, will be here tomorrow to update the inclusion on the board's most recently adopted resolution, Human Right to Water, and what the regional board's roles are and the state board's roles. So you'll hear more about that tomorrow. Something like a question for Dee.
And that's another good reason for keeping it a living document,
right.
So we can build on that as it becomes more less nebulous.
Well, as policies change for Sacramento,
right.
Or we get new authorities to get those in there.
right, yeah.
Let's see, my last question was, disadvantaged communities, do they get any special treatment, or would they just be another, a receptor that would be considered?
We did include that also in our discussion of the regulatory framework, and we discussed it as a site-specific consideration. We would want to be more protective of a disadvantaged community.
Okay, thanks. So the question is here whether the board should accept the final M&A report as guidance.
Does it require a motion?
Well.
Or should we just say we accept?
Well, let's have a motion. Why the heck not?
This is an excellent report, and I really it's a great improvement over our kind of ad hoc approach. I remember when we were dealing with the Army Depot, which I may think maybe the first one of these that we've ever done. And we had to wrestle with a lot of considerations because it was at that point it was new and unfamiliar territory. So this is a vast improvement, and I move that we approve it, accept it, whatever's the appropriate action. Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Accepted unanimously. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.